Let us start by reading the passage that we are going to be going over today together. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Matthew chapter 5, verses 6 through 9. The Sermon on the Mount, and specifically the section of Scripture we have come to call the Beatitudes, is one of my favorite parts of the Bible. They are provocative and poetic, confrontational and compassionate. They critique the world as it is and offer a vision of a world that could be. So much so that many treat the revelation of these passages as fantasy while taking the fantasy of the book of Revelation as literal. I've heard the words of the Sermon on the Mount described as impossible and not for this world, but solely for heaven. And I would say that they are not completely wrong when they say that. These words do seem impossible, but they are not for heaven. They are about the kingdom of heaven drawn nearer and nearer until it is in our midst. In this way, the Sermon on the Mount serves as the charter of the kingdom of heaven, and the Beatitudes serve as the preamble. Similar to the charters of rights and freedoms in Canada and its preamble, whereas Canada is founded upon the principles that recognize the supremacy of God and the rule of law, it lets you know what kind of country this is supposed to be. But as with all analogies and metaphors, they are never one-to-one. They are merely an attempt to help communicate clarity, but alas, they all break down. So as much as I can use the charter as an analogy and say that the Sermon on the Mount is similar, we also know that the Sermon on the Mount is dissimilar and not like it. But that is all part of the way we come to understand anything, especially when we are separated by history. We are forced to make comparisons so that we can understand to the best of our abilities. So the Sermon on the Mount is similar to the Charter as it helps understand what kind of kingdom the kingdom of heaven is. Another way that we seek to understand is by way of comparison. And comparison is to create contrast and juxtaposition. In this way, the Sermon on the Mount utilizes this tool implicitly and explicitly. Later on in the sermon, we hear Jesus say things like, "You have heard it said, but I tell you, ... This is an explicit juxtaposition. But in other parts, like here in the Beatitudes, the juxtaposition is implicit. The reader, when familiar with the context that Jesus is speaking in, or the original audience, as much as we can assume that, understands the contrast that Jesus is holding up in front of them. The kingdom of heaven has often been called the upside down kingdom because it stands in opposition or contrast to the kingdoms of this world, specifically in the context of the New Testament, the Roman Empire, and its accomplices and allies. But that name privileges the kingdoms of this world. Instead, the kingdoms of this world have turned creation upside down, and the kingdom of heaven is what creation looks like restored. So the kingdom of heaven is the right side up kingdom, not the upside down kingdom. The kingdoms that we endure today are the upside down kingdoms. So when we read the Beatitudes, they are speaking to this right side up kingdom in juxtaposition to the upside down kingdoms of this world. So we keep these two uses of comparison in mind, analog and juxtaposition, as we continue to dive deeper into the text together. Today, we are going to look at three implicit juxtapositions that Jesus makes in the section of the Beatitudes that we are exploring. First, the kingdom of heaven's justice and mercy juxtaposed with the Roman Empire's law and order. Second, the kingdom of heaven's purity of heart contrasted against the ritual purity of the religious establishment. And third, the peacemakers of the kingdom of heaven confronting the peace of the Roman Empire called Pax Romana. So let's jump into the first juxtaposition. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Matthew 5, verses 6 and 7. Often, we miss when the Bible is talking about justice because of the words that have been chosen to translate the original language used. In this case, the Koine Greek word that is translated as righteousness in these verses and in much of the New Testament is a judicial word and probably better translated as justice. Normally, I don't like to tear apart the translation choices because it runs the risk of making people think that only those with lots of education or special knowledge can read the Bible, which is not true. Even in this case, you could read righteousness instead of justice and still get pretty close. But at the same time, I believe that certain words need to be unlocked because they will help you read the text better without spending thousands of dollars on seminary. And the word translated as righteousness that should be translated as justice is one of those words. And without trying to create conspiracy theories or attributing malicious intent to the translators of the text, the reason we need to make this shift in language is because of what the English words have come to mean to us here and now. The word righteousness is defined this way contemporarily: the quality of being morally right or justifiable. While justice is defined as just behavior or just treatment. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst to be morally right. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst to be justifiable. This doesn't sound right, does it? Compare that now to blessed are those who hunger and thirst for just behavior. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for just treatment. When broken down this way, justice is about what happens in the world, while righteousness sounds like it is about how people see you personally in this world. So when we continue the verse and read, "For they shall be satisfied," we can see how the word righteousness has led us down the wrong path of our own satiation. All while not necessarily working for a more just world or for justice in this world. When we connect this to the next verse, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy," we see that a theme that emerges from the deep pages of the Hebrew scriptures, especially the prophets: justice and mercy. Justice and mercy have always been central tenets of the kingdom of heaven, and the Sermon on the Mount does not deviate from that. The world has lost justice and mercy and replaced it with law and order. The Empire of Rome in the time of Jesus saw its mandate as bringing law and order to the world. Roman law and order was neither just nor merciful. Instead, it was often oppressive and brutal. Even today, when we hear the phrase law and order, we know that it is coded language for oppression and brutality. We watch videos of police brutality and hear things like, "They should have just obeyed the law." When we see people murdered by state-sponsored agents of the law and order, far too often we see people immediately assassinate the victim's character to justify the assassination of their body. This is law and order, oppressive and brutal. And we can see how if we use the word righteousness instead of justice, the oppression and brutality of law and order are never challenged. So in this way, when Jesus says that those who hunger and thirst for justice and those who are merciful, he is bringing us to a juxtaposition against Roman law and order. The citizens of the kingdom of heaven hunger and thirst for justice and are merciful. Let's look at the second juxtaposition. The kingdom of heaven's purity of heart contrasted against the ritual purity of the religious establishment. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Matthew 5, verse 8. This one seems simple on the first read, but it is actually a much harder concept to explore than justice and mercy. The reason is that purity of heart, or purity pure in heart, is not something that we can just point at and say, look, there is a pure heart. This verse addresses something that is unseen, but shapes the reality of the one that sees it. I think this is why Jesus says the pure of heart will see God. It is a relation of unseen but world shaping with the unseen but world creating. It creates a link between those two concepts. We could spend a lot of time trying to define what is meant by pure in heart, but I suspect that we all intuitively understand what is meant, even if we don't have an official definition of it. We all know someone that we would describe this way, someone whose motives stem from a place of deep goodness. We may say things like they don't have a bad bone in their body, or they have such a good heart. Blessed are the pure in heart is a statement that begins to speak to and about the motives with which one navigates the world. The pure in heart is someone who is connected to the original goodness of this world. Someone who still hears the echoes of God's exclamation that creation is good. They see the good and beautiful, not just that it is possible in the world, but that the good and beautiful is something that is already present in the world. Sadly, these are also the people in this world who often get crushed by the cynicism of others. Pure in heart is not a moral statement. It is not a statement of doing anything wrong, but rather the motive of one's heart. It is not a statement of doing anything right or wrong, but rather the motive of one's heart. So in this way, the pure in heart is not a moral, but motivational statement. And this is why it implicitly critiques religious purity. Religious purity is about doing the right things regardless of motive. It is external, while pure in heart is internal. Jesus spends a lot of time in the Sermon on the Mount expanding on this, exposing the wrong motives but seemingly right actions of the religious juxtaposed with the right motives of the pure in heart. In the time of Jesus, there was an elaborate religious system that determined who was in right standing with God by scapegoating those who were religiously not in right standing. This is not unlike religious establishments today. The Christian tradition I was raised in was much more concerned with the external markers of religious purity rather than being concerned with the internal motives of having a pure heart. If you can list things that would risk your belonging in a religious community, often things named as absolute truth, then we are dealing with religious purity instead of purity of heart. The moment we begin to look at motives, we move from absolutes to the subjective. Remember, only a Sith deals in absolutes. That's a little shout out for my Star Wars fans in the house. But when we get down to the reality of this, it is this: blessed are the pure in heart tells us that citizens of the kingdom of heaven are motivated by the original goodness and look at the interior and not the exterior self. Let's move to our third and final juxtaposition for today. The peacemakers of the kingdom of heaven confront the peace of the Roman Empire called Pax Romana. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. Matthew 5, verse 9. Throughout my life, I have been blessed with some good friends who buy me books for Christmas. And I think it was Christmas 20 years ago when the movie Hotel Rwanda came out. One of my good friends, in anticipation of watching this movie, bought me a book written by a Canadian military officer who was part of the Rwandan peacekeeping mission. This book is called Shake Hands with the Devil, The Failure of Humanity in Rwanda by Lieutenant General Romeo Dallaire. And I would recommend that you read the book. It's a really, really good book. Both the movie and the book dealt with the Rwandan genocide that took place a decade earlier in 1993, when almost a million Rwandans were murdered over 100 days. Now, the role of international peacekeeper units is not there to engage in violence, but to protect. They are not an occupying force or even an intervening force, but they are there to stop warring factions from engaging with one another or to protect civilians from the violence of warring factions. I remember watching the movie Hotel Rwanda, and over again in the film, there is a choice the Canadian peacekeepers are faced with regarding the civilians they are protecting. Allow the civilians to die or engage with the violent mob by returning violence with violence. The whole time I watched the movie, there was a feeling in my heart that I thought it would be justified for the peacekeepers to kill the mob, just shoot them all. Look at the horror that was being done by this mob. Look at the violence that was being done by this mob. But over and over again, they put their bodies on the line without taking a life. They had the capacity to kill, but they preserved life at every turn instead. A friend of mine that I used to work with was there in Rwanda as a peacekeeper. And he told me that at the present time that we were talking, that he still had nightmares about whether or not they made the right choice to not engage the mobs and the Hutu army with violence. He spoke about the stadiums that were filled with bodies. Being a peacekeeper for my friend was not peaceful, but rather a choice of choosing peace when violence and war seem to be the logical response. Often, when we think of peacemakers, we have a utopian vision in our mind of like hippies with flowers or something like that. But peacemakers in this world do not live peaceful lives. Often, peacemakers in this world die at the hands of violence. Let's just be honest about that. No, they put their bodies in front of violence and choose peace as their response. In a world full of violence, they choose to diminish the violence instead of adding to it. We think of Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movements, who in the face of tremendous violence chose peace. Peacemakers are those who hunger and thirst for justice and unashamedly plead mercy and hope that it will win the day. When we look at the civil rights movement and the response to it by the police and violent mobs, we see this in full effect. The police who unleashed dogs and fire hoses on children and tried to beat the people into submission said they were doing this all in the name of law and order. They saw themselves as bringing and restoring order and the rule of law. But whose order? Whose law? In the time of Jesus, his statement of blessed are the peacemakers spoke directly to this. The Roman Empire ruled the so-called world, and they did this through their philosophy of Pax Romana, which translates as Roman peace. Peace to them meant brutally crushing those who opposed them and conquering as far as they could to secure their borders and bring about law and order. We hear a lot about securing borders today and restoring law and order, don't we? You had those in that time who violently pushed back against Rome. We've all heard about the movie Spartacus, right? Which was a violent slave revolt of people who were enslaved by the Roman Empire. We have probably heard about the Zealots in the time of Jesus. Even when we get to the crucifixion of Jesus and we have Barabbas and set free over Jesus, Barabbas was a zealot. He was a revolutionary. He was someone who chose violence against the empire. So you had those in that time who violently pushed back against Rome. And then you had those who followed the way of Jesus and chose to be peacemakers, refusing to add to the violence of the world, but also refusing to back down from it. One of the shrewdest ways of violence in this world starts with words about another's identity. Language that dehumanizes the other, makes fun of them, says they are not like us. And that's no shade at Kendrick Lamar. This is often the starting point of violence. Verbal hostility leads to physical hostility. I think the reason that peacemakers are called the children of God in this passage is because they rehumanize the other. They honor the image of God in others instead of trying to obscure it and diminish it. Peacemakers are not passive. They confront violence with peace, hate with love, propaganda with understanding and truth, and fear with courage. Citizens of the kingdom of heaven do not wage war, but rather confront violence with peace. Today, let us imagine that as a community, as the church, as the people of God, as citizens of the kingdom of heaven, that we give our citizenship in the kingdom of heaven primacy. The world, let's be honest, and for good reason, does not have the greatest opinion of the church right now. And the world would see us as people who hunger and thirst for justice and are merciful if we put our citizenship in the kingdom of heaven as primary. The world would find a community motivated by original goodness instead of trying to hunt out and respond to what we call original sin. Thank you, Augustine. And they would see a community that puts itself in front of, that refuses to back down from the violence of this world, but rather confronts the violence of this world with peace. And as we go through the rest of the Beatitudes, and even look at the Beatitudes that we've already come through, we can compile a list of statements about what does it mean to be a citizen of the kingdom of heaven. And if we keep this list in the front and center of our imaginations, it will help us to be kingdom of heaven citizens first and foremost. It will help us to see these ways of being as our orthopraxy or our proper way of doing things, our proper way of being in this world. And it will help us to see that a good and beautiful world is not just possible, that it is already here, and we get to be the lens through which the world will see it.